I will call the committee to order. Representative Sirdis, having been here for a while, thoroughly read the minutes of March 14th and 15th, so he moves those. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
He voted against.
Okay, Representative Gazelka. And just so members know, with the agenda today, the second bill on the agenda, if members are not ready to move that forward, the one with the construction code and the recodifications, we can hold that over till next week for votes and people want to prepare amendments because it was introduced quite late. And I don't think anyone was able to really review it. But we'll take some testimony today, get that out of the way because we have the time reserved today. So that is it. And Representative Gazelka moves that House File 2794 be recommended to pass and re-refer to civil law. Representative Gazelka.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yesterday's bill that I presented, I felt we'd probably have fairly good agreement once everybody understood it. This one may be a little bit more divisive, but speaking to Representative Mullery ahead of time, but I think it makes sense, and that's why I like this. I'm trying to find legislation in the insurance field that makes sense. House File 2794 is very simple. It has no effect on anyone who owns a car and obeys our laws regarding having insurance, so there's no effect on them. For those who drive their vehicles without auto insurance, which is a crime, this bill would create a targeted penalty that prohibits the owner in a civil lawsuit that is filed as a result of an auto accident from collecting pain and suffering, which is non-economic detriment, which I have passed out the definitions up for that so you can see that. The owner who is breaking the law by driving without auto insurance can collect economic detriment. And so there's, again, all the definitions of all the things that they still can collect is included. Such things as medical expenses, income loss, replacement services, funeral expenses, all are still able to be collected. This bill is intended to create an incentive for drivers to obey our compulsory auto insurance requirements with no cost to the state or any of the other drivers in Minnesota. In fact, if they obey the law, there's absolutely no impact. If they disobey the law, they can't sue for pain and suffering. And so a couple positive consequences that could happen as a result of this law. Right now we have roughly 10 to 15% of the people that drive car insurance disobey the law, have no auto insurance. My hope is that that would be reduced, which would, again, reduce everybody's insurance because you pay a portion of your premium for those drivers. It's uninsured motorists. And secondly, it could potentially reduce collision coverages. And if anybody in here has had this experience where your car is hit, let's say you have a little bit older car and it doesn't have comprehensive or collision, and the person that hits you doesn't have any insurance, sorry, you're out of luck. And typically they're not going to be able to pay because they didn't have the insurance. And so those are two areas that I can see this as being beneficial. So with that, I will answer any questions, and I know there's other people that want to testify as well.
Questions from members? Representative Sirdis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gazelka, what's the status of the Senate file on this?
They are waiting to see what how it goes in the House. For some reason, people feel like this might get lost in civil law, but my opinion is if you have a good bill and a good idea, you should bring it forth and have people dialogue and talk about it and make it the best bill it can be. And in saying that, frankly, the bill yesterday, I picked up a couple of great ideas that will make that a better bill. And so that's why.
Okay. Further questions? Okay, let's take some testimony. Insurance Federation's up first. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll be very brief. We support the House File 2794. This is a bill that in a year and in recent years we've had a growing debate about trying to deal with the uninsured motorist situation in Minnesota. and we clearly are losing ground on that as a state. There's a study that's going to be coming out soon, a nationwide study. We'll get a better handle on the number of uninsured drivers. But here's the issue. What are we going to do as a state to enforce our compulsory auto law? Recent efforts have proven unsuccessful. The systems that we've tried have been cost money, and they've imposed burdens on the honest people who are buying insurance, which is probably not a good result, neither one of those. And so this is an attempt and a bill that I think is fairly targets just the owners who are violating our laws. If we don't want to make it a crime to drive without insurance, we should get rid of the law that makes it a crime and makes it compulsory. If we are going to keep compulsory and make it a crime and say that if people are driving without insurance, we should penalize them, then we should do something to do that. And I think as a state, we've slipped. We're losing ground on that. And as Representative Gazelka indicated, we're surely in double digits, whether it's 10% or 11 or 12 or 13 or 14 or 15. There's a lot of cars on this state that do not have auto insurance. 200,000, 300,000, there's a lot. And everybody here either knows somebody, if not yourself, who's been in an accident or involvement with somebody that's driving without insurance. It's frustrating. So I think from our industry's perspective, this draws a line. This was California has this. It was a ballot initiative that passed in California. I think the count is about five states around this country that have some form of this targeted penalty. This doesn't affect the spouse in the car. It doesn't affect children in the car. It's the owner. The owner climbs in the car, starts it, runs it, is in an accident, and they don't carry insurance. They've broken the law. They continue to be able to receive all the categories of damages that you can quantify, medical bills, lost wages. As Representative Gazelka handed out copies of those definitions in the No-Fault Act. We think it's a reasonable targeted penalty. We think it's good public policy, and hopefully it's an enforcement device that will help encourage people to do what we expect everybody to do, which is to buy insurance when you drive a car. And so, Mr. Chairman, we again think it's a reasonable balance and good public policy and would urge its passage. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from members? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, Representative Gazelka, did you ever see a pro-insurance bill you didn't?
A bill yesterday.
Mr. Johnson, what evidence do you have that this increases the... I mean, I've talked to people when I was with a firm and had to handle these cases that didn't have uninsured drivers. And if you think this was going to get them, you're living in some other planet or something. Do you have proof that this has reduced the rates of uninsured and that the cause is this in other states that have this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mueller, I don't have here today proof from the states that have it. What I'm suggesting is that this is a reasonable public policy balance. If you comply, if you obey the law, this has no effect. Nobody's affected by this if you buy insurance, which is a crime to not buy auto insurance policy and drive in Minnesota. So if you comply with the law, there's no effect. I don't have evidence today that says that if you pass this, that our uninsured motorist rate will drop from, if it's 14% to 13%. So I don't have that. And so I'm working with and looking for ways to deal with the uninsured motorists, and we've got a track record of doing that. We'll continue to commit to look at systems and reporting and issues and ways to deal with. I'm suggesting this is one way, not the only way, because we're going to need to do more of this. And I maybe should have said it this way. This surely is not in and of itself going to solve the uninsured motorist issue. I didn't mean to suggest that. I said it's an additional tool, public policy-wise, that gives a penalty. It's surely a penalty on people who are driving without insurance. And so we believe that it's a penalty that's targeted. It doesn't cost anybody any money in terms of the state or systems or other drivers. And again, if you comply with the law, it has no effect on you, which the majority of drivers do.
Representative
Mueller. Well, Mr. Chairman, we have a lot of laws that there are crimes, and then the we have a penalty for this crime, we have penalties for other crimes. Are you going to start going at several ways to take away the rights of everybody that's a criminal in various different ways? It'd make just as much sense to do that if we're going to go across the board on that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mueller, I haven't seen any other areas in insurance where there's this kind of approach to it. I'll quickly admit that. I haven't. But this is not a new issue. This bill has been introduced and around and in this legislature and for earlier years and earlier eras, and we've debated it before and had, I think, a good discussion and debate about whether or not this is an appropriate penalty. It is a penalty on people who are driving without car insurance.
Representative Gazelka.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I thought this was a novel idea. I thought this was my great new idea. But how it came to me was another insurance agent said there ought to be a law because from an insurance agent's perspective, you're the one that sees these clients that had a situation where they were taken advantage of by somebody that didn't have auto insurance. And so when we were first exploring it, I thought, fine, we'll just say, if you don't have auto insurance, you get nothing. But then we realized, well, what about if there's children in the car? Really, we shouldn't be penalizing them for the decisions of their parents. And, you know, if we exclude the medical part, well, that's going to have to be paid somewhere. So we tried to find a law that took care of the genuine needs that we probably have to pick up as a state anyway, but not reward them for additional benefits for breaking the law.
Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, usually in the past for criminal laws, we have designed things to get at the cause of the crime, and when we take away rights of people, we tie them in. Now, I happen to see the representative from the electricians behind there. If I have my home and I have done something that's a code violation, which is a crime under some cities, and somebody walks in and shoots me, should my homeowner insurance not cover me then? That would make just as much sense as this. Because I had a crime there involved.
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I wouldn't author that bill. I don't know if that's something you want to author. But
I'm saying it's about the same as this. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative, I see it as different. We're not trying to penalize them for their basic needs that they need to take care of, but we don't want to reward them.
Yeah.
For not having auto insurance, and to me they're rewarded. They know that they don't even have to pay and get all the benefits. To me, seems rather ridiculous.
Representative Mueller.
Maybe I should ask a further question. Are you taking away, my understanding was you were taking away their right to sue for pain and suffering. You're not just taking away something on PIP or anything, as I had understood. You're taking away their right to sue. So if I'm sitting at a stop sign and I'm uninsured, I'm 100% innocent, a truck comes up and runs over me, the fact that I have no insurance has absolutely no effect whatsoever on what happened to me, and yet I'm not going to be covered by it. For that.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, I believe I know that answer, but I'm going to let Bob Johnson answer that. I think he'll answer it better than I do.
Mr. Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, and this doesn't stop any ability to file a lawsuit in your fact situation. You can file the lawsuit. The negligent party runs a red light. You'd have a good lawsuit. What this says is that you would not have the ability to recover damages for non-economic detriment,
that's right,
which is pain and suffering. You could file a lawsuit to the extent you had any, again, medical expenses, any lost wages that come out of it, but the pain and suffering category of damage would be the category, but not, it doesn't stop the lawsuit.
So
it limits what
this
you
is
could
a follow-up. You're saying it doesn't stop the I understood what you were saying, but I can't sue for. So if I'm 100% innocent, the other person's 100% at fault, and I'm a paraplegic for life, I get nothing because of your little way of wanting to punish me for maybe having been negligent and not getting my insurance renewed for a month or something.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mueller, it surely is not a you get nothing. I assume that in your fact situation of a very serious injury, you're going to have a quantifiable But medical damages.
I said I get nothing for pain and suffering.
The pain and suffering in right. that situation.
For being a fair for life.
A zero on that. All of the special damages, all of the quantifiable are stay as is.
Now, Mr. Chair, if I can add to that, if somebody was making $50,000 a year, their wage losses would be that amount times X amount of years. That could be a huge lawsuit.
But Mr. Chairman, you're still taking away the fact that I would get it for pain and suffering.
Yes.
Just because my insurance expired. Bizarre.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gazelka, and maybe Bob Johnson can answer this too, but I understand that there's very few cases in Minnesota, any kind of litigation where pain and suffering is awarded. And so maybe you can tell me how many cases have there been in, let's just say, the last year where pain and suffering was compensated in the auto insurance market.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, and there's a couple of gentlemen coming up after me who I'll defer to them. The plaintiff bar lawyers, I think, can tell you that there it'd be quite the opposite. That is a frequently awarded category of damage. It is clearly prominent and a part of, and it varies surely by case, because it does vary by case, but it is absolutely part of and regularly a part of adjudicated auto accident cases. So I know it would not be accurate to say it is an infrequently accessed or used category of damage.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I have a follow-up. Thank you. Okay, so if I have two cars and one of them I haven't renewed the insurance on because I don't drive it, because I'm letting it sit there in case something happens to my other car, and I've got a 16-year-old son who decides one night that he's going to go out driving without my permission, so he gets in that car and he goes out driving and somebody hits him in the kind of way Representative Mullery was talking about, then I'm the driver, I'm the owner, but he's the driver, and he took it without permission, so then you're saying that then there would be no compensation for that adolescent for pain and suffering.
The driver's still covered, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Because he's not the owner, he would be covered. Because you have to be the owner, we wrote it as the owner of the motor vehicle involved in the incident that resulted in the injury, and the motor vehicle was not covered, and the 16-year-old son would not be the owner of that vehicle, in your example.
Thank you.
Wouldn't they also be considered an insured motorist since they have liability coverage, and that goes with the driver and not the vehicle? I'm not a personal lanes guy, so.
I am, but I can ask you.
Mr. Johnson, you know the answer to that?
Well, I believe that as Representative Gazelka identified, that's the answer to that fact situation. In other words, it is drafted to apply to the owner, which look up the title card, who's the named owner on the vehicle. In most cases of the family, it's going to be one of the parents, not the minor children.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Gazelka, and Mr. Johnson. I see that Representative Rukavina isn't here, and so I feel like I have to, I'm channeling him a little bit with this question. Okay, because he would have a lot of fun with this one, I'm sure. But I have to ask you, in Representative Mullery's example of the, say, Representative Mullery doesn't, his insurance is lapsed, he's sitting at this stop sign, he gets hit by a truck, okay? So he doesn't get these non-economic damages. So who benefits from that? And let me just be real clear, isn't the insurance company just keeping money that otherwise would be paid out?
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I wasn't thinking along those lines with this legislation, but if they don't have to pay out a claim, whatever the claim is, you know, that would be a benefit to them. That's not my intent here.
Would it not hold premiums down over time?
Yeah, in effect, then that is returned back to the policyholders and lower premium. I mean,
but Mr. Chairman, can I guess if it was addressed to both of us, if I could respond, and here's the answer. The answer is more straightforward in the following way, that whatever auto insurers in this state pay out in claims in a year, so whatever comes out of auto accidents, the premiums that Minnesotans pay are based on the aggregate amount that we're paying in wheat, that auto insurers are paying in claims. And so it's not a matter of do they get something, that they keep something. They're going to pay out in claims in the course of the year. Those claims are going to be aggregated. They're going to be aggregated by individual companies. They're going to file rates based on what they pay out. So this isn't a profit issue or a find for an auto insurer in an individual file. With the magnitude of claims and files that are processed and the settlements and the dollars that are being paid, there's just a multitude of these facts, you know, situations that are being negotiated, settled. So it's going to, frankly, roll right back to the bottom line of the system, and that's the reason why you see these wide variations in what consumers pay in auto premiums from state to state. It's the same companies that are selling in these states. The variations are because there's a different amount of claims paid. So at the end of the day, the Minnesota consumers, whether this is law or not, are going to pay premiums that are based on the amount of dollars that are flowing out of the system. And so this is one small piece of the big macro, you know, picture of what happens in auto accidents. And so is it likely to be a significant impact on the state and premiums? No. I wouldn't even suggest that. It is a targeted penalty. That's what it is. It is a very targeted penalty. And so, again, I think as we continue the debate, we're committed to dealing with the uninsured motorist problem, and we'll keep doing so, whatever happens on this bill, because we need to figure out overall system solutions if we're going to have a compulsory auto system and enforce it. That debate's been going around up here since we passed compulsory auto. And we're really at kind of a low point in it, in my opinion. And we need to do some things to help that because we've lost ground. And so as a state, you know, what do we want to do, or do we want to do steps to enforce a compulsory auto? I just think it's a debate that we're going to continue to have because we've got compulsory auto. So that issue is here, and we're looking for ways to help it.
So we've got Representative Hamilton, then Representative Clark, then we got to go to the next few witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gazelka, I have many family members that live outstate, and some of those states do not require auto insurance. If they came up to Minnesota to visit me and they got hit by Representative Mullery's bus or truck, would they be subject to this also if they did not have auto insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, I'm not sure. That's a good question.
I'm looking at Mr. Pender might quickly remember also this, that Minnesota, an out-state driver who come, well, I actually have to, I'm going to defer to, I don't know right here at this moment the answer to that about its application to an out-state driver who comes into Minnesota who's had an accident and they're a resident of Iowa, or although Iowa might have no pay, no play. I think it's I'll defer to counsel if he's got a quick answer there, or commit to getting an answer quickly to you.
Mr. Pender, were you following that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to read this section of statute here that covers that.
We burn out earlier.
As I read it, a non-resident is required to have insurance, even if they're not required to be licensed in this state and they're not principally garaged in this state. They shall maintain such security in effect continuously throughout the period that they're operating the car in this state.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll have to explore that more. If this does pass out of committee, I'll work on that before it gets to civil law.
Yeah, that's a great question. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This one question is real simple. What does reparation security mean, actually?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, auto insurance. That's the terminology under current Minnesota law, plan of reparation and security is an auto insurance policy.
It's not comprehensive liability. It's any kind of auto insurance.
Well, it's the Minnesota language under the no-fault law, Chapter 65B, for what insurance we all have to buy in this state as drivers here. Yeah.
And I have a second question, which is, did the Federation have a position on the proposals that have been doing it? A couple of years, not this year, of course, because we're running out of projection, but allowing undocumented citizens to be able to have auto insurance. Did you have a position on that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, no. No.
Okay. Listen, do you?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I guess if you could get more specific, we actually haven't taken any positions on any. That there's been bills. Normally, it would be a bill that if we took a position, but I've not seen any industry positions on any of those issues in that area. I guess that's what I would tell you.
Maybe I have to offer then. Is, you know, one of the groups of people that you're going to impact a lot are those who've been trying to get insurance, but obviously. Currently, does not allow them to sign up for insurance with using a matriculation number or anything, even though there are other states that do. Is that one of the targets? Is that one of the groups of people that you know will be impacted by this pretty significant?
I'm
sorry, can I jump back in, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark? That, I mean, we sell insurance to whoever the state licenses. I mean, that's. Yeah, owns a car. I mean, if the state of Minnesota issues, you know, in other words, if you can legally, through the state laws that govern that, get a license, own a car, then we'll sell. That's who we sell insurance to. Period.
That's fine. How does that
make sense? Yeah,
definitely not. I mean, if I think any group of people, if you're trying to exclude, would fall under. I forget what the exact title is, but redlining issues, and that's, they can't do that, they shouldn't do that. I was simply going to say, if you can own a vehicle, then you should be able to insure it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like the last part of your answer, then I'd like you to join me on a bill that would allow our undocumented residents to be able to use a form of ID that would allow them to get insured, because my understanding in certain parts of the state is it's a major problem of uninsured people. People going to work every day, paying taxes. You know, they're a big part of our communities in some parts of our rural communities in particular, in other places, and they can't get insurance because we don't allow in this state what some other states do, which is allow them to get insurance by being able to use other kinds of identification other than, whatever we end up having here. So I guess we're going to put a bill together on this then, Mr. Chairman.
I had overlooked Representative Pepin. She had her hand up previously. So that question, then we got to go to the next testifier.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to be sure, if I had liability coverage, am I considered insured, or do you have to have full insurance to qualify?
In Minnesota, you're required to have liability, personal injury protection, uninsured motorist, and underinsured motorist. That's the minimum requirement. No comprehensive, no collision, that's not required. Sorry, Mr. Chair, for not addressing you first.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now we got to go to the next, through the Mike Bryant and Joel Carlson. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association, and we are in opposition to this bill, which we feel is unfair and unneeded. Just a couple of points, and then I'd introduce Mike Bryant, who's our past legislative chair for MTLA. One of the things that I think Mr. Johnson indicated is that this has no effect for anyone who obeys the law. And that is absolutely, we believe, not the case. We think this is unfair because it does not relate to fault in causing the accident. And it removes your common law negligence claim at the expense of you or your family and protects drunk drivers and negligent drivers. And it presupposes a legislative fact that if you have insurance, you were doing something wrong, and ignores the facts of what caused the accident. And in that regard, we think this is unfair. I would also say that to the extent we're talking about pain and suffering damages, Representative Gazelka, in all due respect, if you deal with some victims of drunk drivers, they do not believe that pain and suffering is a reward for losing their loved ones and being permanently disabled. That is not a reward for that conduct. And to deny these particular benefits to those who are injured by others' negligence, and that's the only way this applies. If you're negligent and cause your own injuries under Minnesota law, you do not recover. So this only deals with those situations where you are not at fault for the accident. Those are the only instances where this applies. To call that a pain and suffering a reward for that conduct, I think does not at all describe what really happens to those families. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd introduce Mike Bryant and have him talk a little bit about the law and why we're here on policy grounds to oppose this legislation.
Mr. Bryant, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Bryant. I'm from the Bradshaw and Bryant Law Office up in St. Cloud. Historically, there have been a couple of different times where the question for someone who didn't have insurance, who was not at fault, the question was whether or not they could receive their economic damages. There was a case at one point called Munoz, which held that you could not receive your economic damages. And the theory was, if you'd had insurance, your no-fault would have paid those damages, so you shouldn't be able to then collect those against the defendant. Then came along a case called Ramshmooge, and Ramshmooge basically said that if a defendant is at fault, they should pay for what they did. That if you injure somebody, you should pay for what takes place. This bill takes the responsibility away from the at-fault driver. If you get your example like you have where the truck hits somebody and does $1 million worth of damages beyond just your economic damages, because all this bill does is it replaces the wage loss you would have had anyway and pays medical bills you shouldn't have had except for the negligence. And it takes away what your injury is and what happened to you. So to take this bill, it does target a penalty. It makes a huge penalty. You've taken that case, someone who doesn't have insurance, and maybe they didn't pay that week. I thankfully have a great insurance agent who calls me and says, Mike, you got to get your check in today because I forget, and I'll get it in there. But there are people out there who don't have those agents to do it, or those people, because of certain reasons, don't have coverage for a month during this time period as far as it takes place. A person who gets hit by a truck is going to have a $1 million penalty for not having insurance, where the person who's at fault, I mean, if a person who's at fault hits somebody and doesn't have insurance, there's no penalty like that. I mean, their penalty would be the criminal charges that takes place. Maybe there would be some restitution that would be taking place. Maybe the insurance company who pays that insurance might go after them for what they pay. But they ain't getting anything back, and this person's not going to be hurt. It seems to me there's a lot better ways to target people with no insurance. We've gone back to this a couple of times in other hearings about, you know, they stopped asking people to prove their insurance when they did registration. It seems to me that would do a lot more to make people prove that they have insurance than this penalty is going to do, and it's such a harsh penalty to look at it in different ways. You put that all together, it seems like it is really penalizing a person with no fault in a way that just doesn't seem rather inconsistent with the goals of what civil law should be. I mean, if not having insurance is that bad, increase the criminal penalties, because those people still face criminal penalties. But this bill shouldn't be the way to do it. And this bill, I don't think, is going to accomplish what it means to accomplish.
Yes, questions from members. Oh, Mr. Carlson, you have something to add?
Mr. Chairman and members, just briefly to add on to that. They used the example of a white male making $50,000 a year and they'd still get their economic losses. You need to remember that there are a number of people who are victims who do not have economic loss. Their only recovery may be pain and suffering for what they have endured, and those are principally younger drivers and women, and because they have limited economic losses in many instances. So that's who, in addition to this not being particularly sound and not saving any money, the targets of this are really those without any economic gains.
Representative Gazelka.
Just a couple comments, Mr. Chair. I didn't use white male. I just said someone making $50,000. But
And I will work on no insurance and or registration. I think that is another thing that we do need to work on. But one of the issues that we often address is the huge penalties that we deal with that, with auto insurance and drives the costs up of auto insurance. But we're trying to focus on a small group of people. We want to pay all of their basic losses, but we don't want to reward them for not carrying auto insurance illegally.
Questions from members. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gazelka, just a human nature sort of question. You really think that when an uninsured person gets into their car, they would be aware of whatever section of law this is and go, oh, my heavens, I better not drive uninsured because if I get hit by that Coca-Cola truck or the drunk driver, I'm not going to be able to pursue a claim for non-economic damages today? That will be the thing that will put them over the top. They'll call their agent and they'll get insurance today.
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I think the word will get out that you have to carry insurance or you won't get coverage or you won't get a claim. I mean, they won't have the details as far as non-economic detriment or that kind of thing. But I think there actually will be a sense that, you know what, I need to do something here. I think they'll actually think that they get far less benefits than they actually would under the way I've written this law, because we're not taking away their medical expenses, income loss, funeral expense, and all the basic needs we want to replace. I think we should replace. And we're not penalizing them, the children. We're just trying to focus on that group that I think we could get some to change their attitudes towards insurance.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gazelka, I can refer you to two instances. Every once in a while I represent somebody that's been injured in a car accident. And of all the times that I've had uninsured folks come and see me that have been injured in a car accident, about half the time that they're uninsured, it was because they forgot. I'll give you two instances in particular. One was a high school senior, 18 years old, bought a car from a friend, assumed that it would be covered until he called, figured it would be covered under his parents' insurance, drove it to pick up his girlfriend in this new car. As he was on his way to his girlfriend's house, drunk driver, this is 3 in the afternoon, by the way, drunk driver comes across center line, 0.22 or 0.24, puts the kid, they airlift him, it's actually somewhere out kind of where you are, airlifted him to Regions, spent several days in the hospital. He was in a drug-induced coma to bring the swelling down on his brain. My assumption is that this would prevent him from, he was the owner of that car.
Okay.
It wasn't his parents that bought it. He's 18 years old, bought a car, thought he had insurance, knew that he needed to have insurance, just assumed that it would be covered under his parents' policy because that's how insurance works, right? Well, not quite. That's a heck of a penalty, several hundred thousand dollars potentially or more in non-economic damages. The other instance that happened relatively recently, I represented an elderly fella. He forgot that he had insurance on one car. He had taken it off another car, got out, was going to run down to the drugstore to pick up his wife's prescriptions, got into her car that they had taken the insurance off for the winter. Got in that car, drove down, picked up the prescriptions on the way back, got hit by another drunk driver. Would I assume that that would prevent him from having coverage as well? Is that right? Under your proposal here?
Representative Gazelka.
If it falls within the definitions that we've given here, and I think you're saying the 16-year-old owned the car, the first one, the 16-year-old owned the car.
18-year-old, owner of the car, got hit by a drunk driver at 0.25 or 0.24. I came across center line, hit him head on.
Yes, he would not be able to sue for non-economic debt. He'd be able to sue for wage loss, medical expenses, all of the things.
No pain and suffering for him, no pain and suffering for the elderly fella that forgot that he had taken coverage off the one car.
I believe you're correct on your two examples. I insure, Mr. Chair, Representative, I insure quite a few, 2,000 families, and I don't know that I've ever had a case quite like that, but I do know that there is the potential in those cases, which is also why we wanted to make sure we included the basic parts that they should have. It's still their responsibility, the 18-year-old's responsibility to carry insurance, and in that particular example, he would get the basics covered.
Representative Atkins, I'll get your next question, but in the second example, the gentleman had coverage, just not on that car, right?
Right.
So I think he probably still had liability coverage that goes with the driver, if I'm not mistaken.
Not the way this is in.
David's can,
no.
No, that's not correct.
They had taken off the one car.
Insurance and that personal they
Mr. Chair, had to choose between prescription drugs and insurance on the car, so they took it off one of the cars for the winter. The only observation I would make is that if you really want to get after this, make the criminal penalty bigger. This would be a several $100,000 fine potentially on somebody that was running to get prescription drugs for his wife, or on a young man that gets hit by a drunk driver. You're rewarding drunk drivers, for heaven's sakes, or you're rewarding and giving a windfall to insurance companies. I'm waiting to see. I assume there's going to be an amendment, maybe an author's amendment, for a guaranteed premium reduction for the amount of money that this is going to save us, right? Is that coming?
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I'll think about that. But I think based on you brought up a good question, Representative Atkins, and I do want to pursue that more. And so, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I think I'd like to lay it over at this point. I've got another bill I got to present in education finance right now anyway. So.
All right. It would be good timing so we can get to the other bill. So the Chair will lay over House File 2794.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Walker,
over.
We can probably get you on the road fairly quickly here.
When you start taking away people...
Representative Soderstrom moves that House File 3464 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Walker, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Would you like to take the amendment first?
Why don't we do that?
Okay. The Chair will move the A1 amendment. Representative Walker, to the A1 amendment. Is that just get it in the shape you want to discuss it?
Yes.
Okay. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3464. Actually came to me. I've been doing tours of the prisons, actually on a separate note, because of complaints that I've been getting since we've gotten rid of the omnibusmen for the inmates there, and decided to go on a few tours, especially looking at treatment, reentry, and the training programs that are in our different prisons, and went down to Shakopee, and there is this wonderful new area that's just been created for training of beauticians. If you haven't been down there, you have to go see. But here's the catch. We have something in statute that would limit these individuals coming out of Shakopee from being able to obtain a license from the Board of Barber and Cosmetology Examiners. And so we want to be able to exempt them. The amendment that you just passed actually was just to make sure that individuals that were off paper, off probation, things of that nature, would also be able to qualify. Excuse me, on paper.
All right, any questions from members? Do you have any testimony, other testimony, or you're
just
here to help?
He's just an expert from the Department of Corrections, just in case you guys have hard questions.
Now, my understanding is, I think on the barber board side, this is as we're lining this up with their current policy. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Walker. I'm just kind of curious as to the history of this. Why cosmetology and barbers? I don't know, was it some scissor execution sometime, or what was the impetus for this?
Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, I'm not quite sure. However, there is not an equity because, as Mr. Chair just said, the barbers have been able to do this in the past, and so we just want to make sure that the women that are coming through the cosmetology have the same opportunity.
And Representative Gunther.
Yes, to that point, Mr. Chairman, I was part of the reason that the barbers and the cosmetologists merged. Governor Quay eliminated the cosmetology board, and it got so bad that they were paying a couple million dollars for two inspectors, and I thought that was a little steep. And I thought they should have a say in their profession. After all, there's 35,000 or so of them. And what we thought the only way we could do it is merging them with the barbers, and the barbers agreed, and we passed a bill to do that last year, year before. And now, in order to enforce all their laws, we have this bill before us, and I appreciate your work in that. Thank you very much.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really glad that you're bringing this bill, and I just wanted to make a comment. If this doesn't pass, I had a client who went to cosmetology school, and had a felony record, and it just, I didn't realize that this was in the law, and it makes me wonder, can they just, the schools, apparently, according to my client's experience, are just taking people's money and never telling them that, in fact, they will not be able to get a license. So I sure hope this passes, and if it doesn't, I think we need to do something about it on the other end so that people's money isn't just being taken for a profession that they, in fact, cannot enter.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Walker. That, what Representative Liebling said, confused me a little bit, because I don't believe there's anything that prevents them from getting a license now, is there?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin. I just got from the department, Barbara Cox, who just whispered in my ear, and maybe you guys were able to hear it, because it was a loud whisper, that it that it's up to the board itself. They take it on. So that individual that Representative Liebling was just referring to may or may not have been able to get their licensure.
Representative.
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker. Well, I think it's great that we give ex-felons a chance to redeem themselves and and make society better. So I think it's a generally a good idea. I do have a question, though. This kind of just brings up another question that you or maybe your witness can answer. What is the current process? If I'm an ex-felon coming from Shakopee and say I'm a pedophile or, have that type of thing, is there any disclosure that's required currently? So if I, can an ex-felon who's a pedophile work at Kids Cut or Kids Hair or, you know what I'm saying?
Mr. Chair, Jim Verhoeven, Education Director at the Correctional Facility in Shakopee. Representative, essentially my understanding is that it's done on a case-by-case basis, and so the Cosmetology Board does currently have the ability to limit in those types of cases.
Are they able to ask the question if once we pass this? Are they able to ask the question so that they know that someone's got a felony record?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Barbara Cox from the Department of Corrections. What I was just going to add to Mr. Verhoeven's testimony is that this licensing does not supersede any other laws that are currently in statute about working with vulnerable adults, working with kids, etc. So there's all kinds of prohibitions in statute. If you are convicted of a pedophile offense, for instance, you can't work with kids. You can't work in a daycare, etc. If you have been convicted of a violent offense, I don't think, I'm not an expert on these things, but you can't work in a nursing home. So you couldn't be the beauty shop lady at the assisted living facility. So it doesn't supersede any of those things. And you have to disclose when you apply for a job that you are a felon. So they will know if it's kids' hair. I'm sure the kids' hair's attorney and, liability situation will make sure that they would establish that, were you a meth addict or a pedophile, etc. So it doesn't change the requirement that people disclose that they're a felon. It doesn't change any requirements about who specific populations that they can and can't work with. It just says that they can get actually the license.
Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to figure out where this ends up. If we pass this, can they still, if this becomes law, can the board, but can the board still deny a license for a felony? Now, because I used to do work with licensing, and it would depend on the type of felony, for instance, as to a liquor license. Some types of felonies like if it was with regard to theft, things like that, you couldn't get a liquor license. Other felonies, you could. Surprised me you could get one with murder, but there would be different kinds of things that might have an effect on protecting the clients of that person. In other words, if somebody had let their insurance lapse and was driving, I'm not worried about that felony, but there might be some that would. Can the board still deny it on the basis of the type of conviction they have if this becomes law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, my understanding is that the way it is worded, no, that's not the case. If this were to pass, that the type of felony would not matter. However, I must say, in our particular case at Shakopee, we have a very careful screening process, and so we're already screening out, for example, sex offenders and not having them in our program, for example. So we have a very careful screening process in place. However, if this were to pass, the type of felony would not matter. What would matter is that person completes the very rigorous 1,550-hour course requirement and meets all the board standards, passes all the board exams, and is then eligible for licensure. So it's a very rigorous program. Our program is a 14-month program, for example.
Mr. Chairman, do you know whether... I mean, I don't see any reason that there should be a distinction between cosmetology and barbers, but I don't see why there shouldn't be allowed the board to determine that this person's past record is such that they want to protect clients. And I don't know what the reasons would be. I can't think offhand, but it seems like, are we taking away the right of that board to determine that certain types of felonies should not, if you've committed certain types of felonies, you shouldn't be, at least within so many years, working with clients or whatever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I think as Representative Walker indicated, it has a lot to do with the equity issue, and for decades we've had barber programs at two of our men's correctional facilities, and they've been able to be licensed, and so this is more in line of bringing equity in that regard. But as I mentioned, the industry itself and the board have very rigorous standards that have to be met in order for people to be licensed.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll let this go and try and find out somebody from the barber board or cosmetology may be able to answer the question a little bit.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, Representative Soderstrom renews her motion that House File 3464 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Walker. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Mr. Chairman, I think the decision to hold this over is probably a good idea due to the fact that it was just brought out, but I do want to go through the bill, correct?
Yeah, we'll move the bill and then lay it over. So Representative Simpson moves that House File 3525 be recommended to pass. We refer to government operations. Representative Simpson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to go through the overview, and then I have a Commissioner Rosalind Wade with me and Tom Jokum from the Department of Labor and Industry, and they'll go through the bill. Okay?
Okay.
The overview is this is the State of Minnesota Drive to Excellence. April 2005, Governor Tim Pawlenty initiated Drive to Excellence with five executive orders and a reorganization order. The purpose to refocus state government as an enterprise serving all citizens rather than independent entities serving individual citizens. It creates a long-term solution for the challenges and opportunities ahead. Demands of citizens and businesses for faster, better, and cost-effective services. Surge in state retirement beginning in 2015, when nearly half of the current state workforce will reach 60 years of age. Reorganization Order 193 is a code of consolidation. Building construction regulations have been consolidated from 5 unconnected agencies to a construction codes and licensing division. Now a one-stop shop in the Department of Labor and Industry. Construction industry code officials and the public have a single and consistent touch point for construction and building code information. New construction codes and licensing division will be newly created. CDL is comprised of Department of Administration's Building Codes and Standards Division, Department of Health's Plumbing and Engineering Unit, Board of Electricity's Electrical Inspection and Licensing Unit, Department of Commerce's Residential Contractor Licensing Unit, Department of Labor and Industry's Boiler and High Pressure Piping Unit. Additionally, Labor and Industry was granted the authority for promulgation of the State Fire Code. This proposed legislation is a bill to complete the reorganization order, creating a one-stop shop for construction code and licensing. The general changes are as follows. Number one, all department references to previous state agencies have been changed to the Department of Labor and Industry. Number two, all commissioner references have been changed to the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. Number three, a number of clerical and grammatical changes have been made to clean up dated language. And number four, in all the articles representing the consolidated units, we have changed the references to specify funds, either general or special revenue, to now be listed as construction codes fund account. So that's kind of the overview of what we're doing here. And with that, I will turn it over to Commissioner Wade.
Commissioner Wade, welcome.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Rosalyn Wade. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Workplace Services Division that includes the newly formed Construction Code and Licensing Division. Representative Simpson have provided you a bit of the information that I had intended to cover. So in consideration of the time before the committee left, I'm going to pass the baton over to our new Executive Director of the Construction Code and Licensing Division, Tom Joachim.
Go.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tom Joachim. I'm with the Department of Labor and Industry. I believe all of you received the handout of the summary of the bill, and I'm going to walk through and just highlight some of the areas. If you have questions, I will try and answer them. We do have our specific staff leaders in each of the departments here if there's a specific question to any of the electrical, plumbing, boiler concepts. So, if you have, following the summary that was handed out, Article 1 is just some revisor's instructions. Article 2 is follow-up to the reorg order addressing the State Fire Code Rulemaking Authority, which transfers the responsibility for promulgation and adoption of the State
Excuse
Fire
me,
Code.
Mr. Joachim, Mr. Chair, we don't have the summary here.
Oh, you don't? It's not a House research summary. It's a summary provided by the department.
It's a new method.
Thank you.
Mr. Joachim, go ahead. Representative Mallory.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering why House Research didn't get a thorough summary of this 160-page bill that she got this morning.
Self-explanatory, probably, but your point is well made. Mr. Joachim.
Continuing on, Article 2 was the transfer of the promulgation and adoption of the State Fire Code, and I'll give you a short version of the reasoning of that. Previously, I was the manager of the Building Codes and Standards Unit, and when we adopted the State Building Code, we worked in conjunction with the State Fire Marshal's Office to adopt the State Fire Code. When you are in two agencies, you have two different revisor's offices to take rules through. We have compatible pieces of the Fire Code and Building Code. When they were adopted, as we both submitted them, both revisors would tweak the language, and then we'd have to go back and forth. It took us about 3 months to get the language that both revisors could agree to. So this is one of the pieces, is to move all the code adoption piece under one agency. Continuing on, Section 2 and 3 are are just, again, some definitions and transfer responsibilities that are covered in kind of the general transfer criteria. Section 4 is the construction code fund. We moved all of the accounts from the boiler high-pressure piping, the contractor licensing, the electrical, building codes and standards, and plumbing unit into this construction code fund. So we have one fund that addresses this new division. Section 5 addresses the examination. In the building code unit, we certify building officials. The current language just says that we have to develop and administer the tests. There are now national certifications that were available to use. Some of them haven't picked up on our Minnesota rules, so we added a piece in there that if they do not pick up our Minnesota rules and our national certification, we can require them to attend a mandatory training program on the rules and regulations in Minnesota to get them started in their process as the designated building official. Section 7 addresses subpoenas, and this basically says the commissioner staff are not subject to subpoenas. The concern there is that this restriction would prevent the commissioner or staff from being required to act as an expert witness in private civil matters as it relates to inspections and investigations it performs. It would not prevent subpoena for other purposes. Article 3, this is probably the most change that you will see in the bill. What we did was in our boiler, high-pressure piping, electrical, plumbing, and residential contractor units, we all had some type of enforcement tools that we were using to, in our term, below-the-line activity. In all of our activity is inspections that we do. We go out and make an inspection. We have a correction notice. 85-90% of the corrections are made. The project continues on. It's not a problem. The 10% that we run into where we run into somebody that doesn't make corrections and the second notice they don't make the correction again, we needed some tools to address how they're going to make these corrections. And this enforcement piece combined the best practices of the five or six units into a new enforcement tool. And if you look at the highlighted or underlined four areas that we've increased or addressed here is try to get consistent with all of them so that any of the inspectors that are out there, if we have a situation that gets below the line of not compliance, that we have consistency on how we send out the notices and notices of violation, the stop orders, the licensing orders, and the administrative orders are consistent across the board for each of the units in our new division. Next article is Article 4. This is addressing the changes.
Representative Mulray.
Mr. Chairman, before we get too far from it, I wanted to ask a question on the limit on subpoenas. Where I've never heard of such a law anywhere. Can you tell me where else in statute this is? So anything like this?
Mr. Fulton.
Mr. Chair.
Someone's been reading statutes.
I think he's got a memory.
Don't you?
Mr. Chair, Representative. From our legal services from the labor and industry, we've got listed here the statute number 182.659, subdivision 8, which addresses this very same issue.
That's what I was thinking. You just forgot about it.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's what you were thinking.
Okay. Mr. Joachim.
Continuing on to Article 4, this addresses the changes in the building codes and standards unit. Again, sections 1, 2, and 3 are basically changes from administration to labor and industry and some correctness. We went from handicap disability to persons with disabilities in the law to meet the correctness in language. Section 5 addresses the clarification for adding boarding care homes and residential hospice. Health Department licensing division that licenses nursing homes. These are included in it, but are not listed in the law. So we wanted to include those in the list of the nursing home just to clarify that they are included as far as the requirements for final review and inspections of our office. Section 6 is a cleanup addressing, again, the Construction Code Fund and moves to Department of Labor and Industry. We are repealing the wheelchair lift section that's within the law because it's now covered by the codes that we adopt within our elevator code. Turning, next section 11 is certification. This again addresses the commissioner allowing the commissioner to accept the national certification and requiring the mandatory training. Section 22 brings back our Construction Codes Advisory Council that was sunset 3 years ago. We have dropped two of the state agencies that are now consolidated with the department and added in plumbing, electrical, and high-pressure piping contractors to the advisory council and proposing to add in a utility company representative. And again, this council has previously provided the information back to the commissioner administration and now would be able to provide information back to the commissioner of labor and industry in regard to codes and licensing activities. Sections 42, 43, 44, 45, and 46.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said that you're reinstating the Construction Codes Advisory Council. Now, I am not an expert on this, obviously, but I know there was a Mechanical Codes Council, there was an Electrical Council. I can't remember what other ones are. Are these all being merged into one, or will each one of these that are presently existing continue to exist for their trade?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the advisory councils that were in the specific areas are still being maintained, as I will get to in the electrical piece, where we moved from the Board of Electricity to the authority to the commissioner. That board is now becoming an advisory council to the commissioner. But this council is the umbrella council of all of them, so that we will have a representative of every one of the industries that the codes that we address will be on this advisory council. So we're still going to maintain the ones that are there.
Representative Mullery, here. I can tell there's a question coming out.
Well, go ahead now.
All right. Mr. Joachim.
Continuing on with the sections 42 through 46, this adds or modifies definition of the licensed limited dealer or retailer and manufacturer facility and owner. We're trying to clarify who needs to hold the license to sell the manufactured homes, and then we're clarifying we have manufactured plants that have a main plant in Illinois, and they may have five other plants in other states, and we want to make sure that the plant the building is being shipped from is licensed to function and to ship into Minnesota, not just the main plant in Ohio. So that's what we're attempting to do here. Section 50 is a limited dealer license. Section 51 is a notice to commissioner. Article 5 is the changes to electrical. And again, I'm not going to cover all of this, the kind of the general changes. Probably the key one that we were just discussing is, if you go to the fourth bullet, is that modifies the membership of the third bullet. Rename the Citizen Board of Electricity as the Electrical Advisory Council and make it advisory to the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. In the reorg order, the Board of Electricity was reassigned, responsibilities were reassigned to the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. So we're making that board an advisory council to the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. The fifth bullet down, Section 15, clarifies that an individual may only be responsible, licensed individual, for one contractor. We've had cases where licensed individuals attempt to work for more than one contractor, and this clarifies that they're really only allowed to work for one contractor under their license category. Section 15, Subdivision 6A, increases the contractor bond from $5,000 to $25,000 to be consistent with the other contractor bonds that we have within our new division. In a number of these cases, you will see, as in Subdivision 8, that we are moving licensing fees from rule to statute. Now that all the agents have to bring all the fees or any fee increases through the legislature, so we're moving those right into statute.
skipping a one. We're deleting some disciplinary provisions of 326-242 subdivision 9 and adopting the enforcement provisions that we talked about earlier, that where we changed and added everybody together. Subdivision 11 establishes requirements for issuing personal licenses through reciprocity with other states, so we can combine if, for example, we have any. Hopefully we don't, but we were lucky last year, but we have had tornadoes and flood damage, and this will allow us to have some reciprocity with electrical and other licensed activity in neighboring states. I'm going to skip to Article 6 on plumbing. The plumbing inspection and engineering section has right now ability to sign or has agreements with local jurisdictions. This just clarifies what we as a department would want with those agreements and how they would be handled between us and the city if they're going to do the plan review and inspections in their community. Section 8 addresses the change from apprentice to trainee, and the reason is that now that the plumbing license program has moved from health department to labor and industry, this change is proposed to prevent confusion between the two programs. The word trainee will now be used to identify a person registering with DLI to track experience hours for the plumbing license exam. Section 8 talks about the direct supervision of the plumbing trainees. This would allow up to a master or journeyman plumber to supervise two trainees at one time.
Representative Muller has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Joachim, with this change from apprentice to trainee, is there a guarantee that this will have effect everywhere in law and rules that apply to apprentices right now? In other words, if he's changed to trainee, there's rules that apply to apprentices. Can new rules be made, or there's statutes that require rules to be specifically such and such with regard to apprentices? If you call them trainee, can you get out of that, first of all, with regard to Minnesota, and second of all, with regard to federal regulations on apprenticeship programs, etc.?
Mr. Jordan. Mr. Wade.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I think that it would take a bit of research on our behalf to fully explore the depth of your question. However, I'd like to just indicate that the sole purpose of this provision is to clarify any confusion. Formerly at the Department of Health, individuals who were participating in a plumbing training program was referred to as an apprentice. As you are well aware, the Department of Labor and Industry has called the registered apprenticeship program for the state of Minnesota since we started that program. So for many years, there was often confusion about whether or not individuals that were registered at the Department of Health had the same benefits or specifications as required under the law. Now that Labor and Industry has both programs, we're simply seeking to clearly distinguish those individuals who are registered with a plumbing unit for the sole purpose of tracking their hours to ensure that they can sit for the licensing exam. We want to clearly distinguish to stakeholders that there is a difference between those that are simply registering for purposes of counting hours versus those individuals that are formally registered in an apprenticeship program through the apprenticeship unit.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't think I have a problem with what you're getting at. I want to make sure that it doesn't affect other legal rights and things like that.
Okay, Mr. Chilton.
Moving on, Section 10, again, move some fees from rule to statute. We have two Section 10s. That should have been Section 9, I guess. Misprint. The second Section 10 transfers plumbing plan review fees from manufactured home parks or campgrounds
from Minnesota Department of Health. And what that addresses is previously in the health department, the plumbing unit and the health department did plan review and licensed the RV parks and mobile home parks. And what this does is say that the health department is responsible for all of that activity in that park, being the health department. The plumbing unit that is now with labor and industry used to help out to make some of those inspections, and in a crossover program, we're just saying that we're giving them their full responsibility that to follow up on that program. They have the people to do it. They have the same qualified engineers. The engineering department is doing the plan review. Some of those engineers stayed with health department. Some of them came over with us. So we're just clarifying that that's their responsibility totally on the parks.
Okay, Representative Saylor, did you have a question to that area?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to that area, but at the end would be fine.
Sure.
Or no.
Please proceed.
Article 7, water conditioning. Probably the main change there is the second line is moves the fees from rule to statute. Article 8 is the residential building contractor section. We first bullet is transferred some signed contractor bond authority from commerce to labor and industry to move that over. Second bullet, moved rule requirement for writing contracts to statute and clarify elements that are required in the written contract. We've clarified the definition of owner for people who work on their own properties. Again, fourth bullet, clearly enable the commissioner to contact with outside vendor for licensing exam. We want to make sure we had the ability to use any, cost-effective outside contractor to help us with our licensing programs, rather than have to do it ourselves. So this gives the commissioner authority to look at that. If it's cost benefit to us, we'll use that program. If it doesn't, we'll continue to do it within in house. Continuing on, requires licensees to notify us of bankruptcy filing, criminal conviction, judgment arising from contracting actives. Second, next bullet, code violations will be documented by a certified building official. The current law says a Minnesota licensed structural engineer. Right now, all within the building code community, the building officials are the ones that document the building code violations, so we're just changing it to that. We're increasing the liability insurance minimum coverage from $100,000 to $300,000. We're changing the recovery fund deadline for standard claims from December 31st to June 30th to match up with the fiscal year. And we're increasing our accelerated recovery fund claim limit in the accelerated fund from $15,000 to
$25,000.
Mr.
Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
I do have questions on that section in particular, so maybe Mr. Joachim can help me here. A couple of things. On the one bullet that says you require licensees to notify you of bankruptcy filing, criminal conviction, and judgments arising from contracting activities, I assume that means. Is that also to notify you if, for example, what's happening a lot in the industry where builders go out of business and open up under a different name and then a different company name, and then the residential homeowners have difficulty trying to find out where their warranty resides, or if they still have a warranty? Is there something in here that is going to be addressing that? I mean, are they obligated either under current law or under your changes to let the department know when they change from one company name to another? Because right now it's very hard to track that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, I'll wait for that answer for a few minutes, but while I'm waiting for that, I want to know if your department licenses the individual builders as well as licensing the company, or and if so, can you take action against either or when there's been multi-construction and so forth?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, my name is Charlie Durenberger. I'm the manager of the Enforcement Services Unit here. And this is an issue. I was the supervisor in the Investigations Unit at Commerce when Commerce regulated building contractors. And this is one of our concerns as builders, especially if they're not competent or negligent, that they're not allowed to just start one company, close it down, and start up another one. So if they do that, if they, for whatever reason, one company no longer does business and that builder wants to start another one, they're going to have to apply for a new license for that company. And on that license application, we ask a series of background questions that gets at, have you been licensed before? Have you been the subject of lawsuits? Do you have a criminal history? All sorts of background questions to try to stop that from happening.
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Representative Goodwin.
Well, Mr. Durenberger, it's not working. And there was a court case in November that the Supreme Court said, Minnesota Supreme Court said that if they open up under another name, as long as they dissolve their company under the dissolution statute 502, then they can open up another company. So, and then they're not responsible for the warranties. I guess in general, we really need, I really want to sit down and talk to you two outside of this committee because I've had just numerous complaints about what's going on in this area and with the enforcements by the department or lack thereof of enforcement by the department previously when it was under commerce and currently while it's under labor and industry. So I think we've got some real enforcement issues that we need to deal with, and maybe that's because you don't have the staff or whatever. But I can let you talk to a whole slew of homeowners' attorneys that will tell you that companies can, that they've had builders go in and out of business 4 and 5 times to avoid the warranty on homes. So it is happening. And so I guess I'm wondering, because I'm not quite sure about this, is the license under just the company name, or is it under the individual builder's names? Are both licensed, or either or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, it's the company that actually holds the license, but the company has to name one individual who is an owner or officer or managing employee of the company to act as what's called the qualifying person for the license.
Right.
And so that individual is responsible for passing the licensing exam to show some minimum level of competency and understanding of the applicable laws and codes. But it's the company that actually holds the license. And we can take action against the company, against their license, if any of the owners or officers or the qualifying person of that company engages in prohibited conduct. And we can take action against or deny a license of a company in the future based on the conduct of owners, officers, or qualifying persons of companies that had been licensed previously. I think one of the issues that we faced in the past is we're not omniscient. We don't know every lawsuit that's going on out there. We don't know of every problem. So to the extent that there are lawsuits that are being filed, if the consumers that are involved in them aren't notifying us and aren't letting us know, it could very well be that builders are misrepresenting their litigation history in their applications and getting through that way. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're proposing that we be notified in these cases so that we're not just being reactive to, you know, well after the fact we find out about something. We want to know right away.
And Mr. Chair,
that sound good, huh?
And Mr. Durenberger, that's commendable, and I think it's really important that you do have a way to find out that information. I also think it's important that your department have some way for homeowners to find out what kind of actions have been taken against builders or building or companies, so that they know whether or not they want XYZ company to build their home or not, or whether or not they've gone out of business 4 or 5 times. So I would say, in the interest of the consumers, I hope that you are working on developing ways that we can share that information with the public, because right now they have no way of checking on the builders to see if they have been. Another thing I want to say quickly is that homeowners have told me that they have contacted the department, that you don't have near enough inspectors there to help them, and the ones that have been really good have been released by the department and or are no longer there or are asked, you know, not to talk to legislators or other people. So I'm hoping that situation can be corrected as well, because we've got a lot of work to do in this area, and I think, you know, some of it might be building codes, some of it might be the licensing process, but I haven't seen anything come out of your department in the fourth year I've been dealing with this issue, and I haven't seen any recommendations for how we can make the system better, both to work for builders, insurers, and homeowners. So far, I haven't heard word one about anything you folks are doing in that area. But I am concerned about the contractor recovery fund here, and I think there are some changes that need to be made to that as well. And I wondered if because right now a homeowner has to succeed in a loss, an actual lawsuit, in order to recover, and the most they can recover is $50,000. And I know the governor took money out of that contractor recovery fund to balance our budget, and I'm wondering how many, maybe this is a conversation for later, but I just think that, I wonder how many people actually get to make use of that fund, and whether or not we need to find ways to make that, to actually add money to that fund, and certainly keep the money in there that's supposed to be in there, and make sure there's better access for homeowners that are not, that whose builders, either they find out they didn't have insurance, or the builder goes out of business and jilts them on the warranty, that they can get some compensation for repairing their homes without having to go through an entire lawsuit, which it's going on forever because the insurance companies are keep it going for 3 or 4 years until they wear the homeowner down. But at any rate, there's a lot of work in this area, and I want to be able to have the opportunity to read the language well here. And so I appreciate the fact, Representative Simpson, that you're going to lay this over when we're done here. And I would like to talk to people from the department. I don't want to sit here and accuse you, and I'm sorry, and I know you're doing the best job you can a lot of times with the resources you have to work with. But it's an issue that affects all Minnesotans. So homeowners and especially those with warranties and so forth. So whatever I can do to help you help the homeowners, I'm happy to do that. In the meantime, I'd like to meet with you before this bill actually comes up again, and you too, Assistant Commissioner, so we can talk about some of these issues. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simpson, I was wondering, this is a lot to comprehend, I was wondering if you could provide us with a side-by-side comparison of what is existing law versus the changes or the new languages, and if so, by when could we expect that?
Have you worked on that yet, Representative Simpson?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we will work diligently over the weekend on that, and I think before our next committee we'll have that available. It's a great idea. I think we all need a little simplification. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this question would be for Mr. Joachim. I was just wondering, as I'm looking through here, going back to Article 4, Section 22 on page 36, looking at the membership of the Construction Codes Advisory Council, as I'm looking through that, I'm noting there were some deletions. And I'm a little bit concerned that now when we have renewed concerns for energy conservation in the state of Minnesota, looking at high fuel costs, and we're looking for efficiency wherever we can, I was wondering why we would remove the Commerce Department's Energy Office from the Construction Codes Advisory Council. Perhaps that's been inserted somewhere else, and I simply didn't see it. But I thought that was interesting that when we're looking at energy conservation, they have been removed from this council. Similarly, the environmental health section has also been removed, and again, perhaps it's somewhere else in the document that I simply didn't see. And the second question, would just sort of following along that direction, would be where in the document are the provisions for addressing energy conservation? I think it's kind of interesting, you know, so many times we note that people accuse the government of the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing. And I thought it interesting to note that in the January 05 legislative audit report, there was a very thick report on conservation, energy conservation, and it specifically directed the 06 legislature to consider energy conservation this year in a number of bullet points. But I will just suffice it to say, I was concerned to see that is not addressed, that those folks are not on the advisory council, and I would like to know what provisions are within this bill for that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the changes to the advisory council are dropping the two state agencies that are now with the Department of Labor and Industry. So the health department plumbing unit that was representing, environmental health unit that was representing the plumbing unit on the code council is now within our department. So they are represented. The energy division from Department of Public Service, or excuse me, Commerce, is now, they three years ago, I believe it was, transferred the energy code requirements to through the Department of Administration, which are now transferred to the Department of Labor and Industry. So within our Construction Codes and Licensing Division, we have our Energy Code Unit that will be represented through our representative on the Construction Codes Advisory Council. So we've covered those two on the council. So I think you had one more question. I can't remember what the third question was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Yocum. It was just wanting to know where else in this document there were any provisions specifically addressing energy conservation, since it was brought up by the Legislative Audit Commission as something that the state of Minnesota ought to seriously consider. I just wondered if you had other provisions. And thank you very much for clarifying where they were in this document, or at least where they're included in the process. Thank you.
As Representative Mullery, Liebling, and Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Was it Durenberger? Is that, are you brother of David?
Brother? Yeah, I do have a brother named David, yes.
That's what I was talking about, the one that works at HCMC.
Oh, yes.
Just a little block from me, okay. with regard to the residential building contractors, the insurance, as you're certainly aware, there's a problem after that decision in November. Now, that could be corrected by just you requiring either a rider or a policy language change that would carry over after a dissolution. Are you doing anything about protecting consumers that way by requiring that in the insurance policy they provide?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, no, we have not proposed anything in that regard.
Are you going to in the very near future?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, that is not something that we've discussed, other than we do have a proposal to increase the minimum requirement for the policy limits for liability for builders from $100,000 to $300,000.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Durenberger, that won't help the issue at all. That wouldn't. There's a huge problem after that decision with lack of coverage for consumers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the this is our cleanup bill to follow the reorg order. As we are all consolidated now, one of the things we've done is establish function teams to look at activities that we're doing, and we were preparing to develop over the summer each of these specific activities to say, what do we need to change now in the residential contractor licensing that has more teeth than some of just this cleanup? Because if we put too much teeth in this bill, we're gonna be, and we still might be with this bill all over the place. But our concern was to try and cover just the reorg order and some grammatical changes and stuff that really needed to be done to follow the reorg order, and then spend our summer looking at a new fee structure, looking coming back next session, talking about that to address what we need to do to make this new consolidated group work.
Mr. Chairman, a couple other.
Representative Mullery, quickly, I think, because we've got a.
I just got two questions. One is, do you have something, maybe it'd be Mr. Durenberger again, with regard to the issue of when somebody's license is pulled? Minneapolis had a provision that then they would be, like, if their spouse started a company, they couldn't then be participating in that company or on job sites or anything like that. Is there anything like that at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, no, but I don't recall that Minneapolis had that provision either.
And Mr. Chairman, the other question is, I noticed on the Construction Codes Advisory Council, they're deleting the representative of the construction trades unions. Why are we taking out it seems to me like the workers should have a representative on. They're not exactly taking over if they have one out of how many, 11 or more members.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Joachim.
I think what we looked at was all the representatives that we have with plumbing and building and residential contractor licensing and electrical and mechanical and high pressure piping, we have representatives on the council that would be from the trades associations.
But Mr. Chairman, they're not from the actual workers, they're from the employers.
Mr. Shulkin.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. Yeah, they could be. I guess a plumbing contractor could be a worker that's working. Same with the high pressure piping.
But probably not.
Okay, members, we're gonna I'm gonna lay the bill over for next week, and we'll have more opportunity for questions, and we will take more testimony next week. I had asked members to put the bill and the materials in their folders so we can.
Thank you.
Not fill as many trees. I'm gonna read it all day Saturday. So we're adjourned.
Thank you.